Here is a bulletin from Kennedy's motorcade.
7-6. We have main engine start.
Gutted shells of buildings, flames raging out of control.
The devastation is so widespread.
It follows a security alert earlier this morning.
It is July 20th, 1969.
Breaking news, major corruption crackdown going down.
Time to make up your mind about people as never.
Sonny, there's only one word to describe what's happening, and that is panic.
The description on one wire service, master criminal.
All right, everybody, welcome on back. It's Twisted History. I think we're like 60 shows or something into it. And the person who's been back the most times outside of Vibs is Jerry Thornton. He's back today with us to do the Twisted History of Bad Medicine. Good afternoon, Jerry. How are you?
I'm great, Large, and thank you for having me back so many times. A part of me thinks that it's because I've lived a lot of history more than other people, but I'm not insulted.
Excellent. And so Jerry is one of the writers, people who are tuning in and hearing Jerry's voice for the first time. He's one of the writers here at Barstool Sports. He's been around for a long time with the company. He's our resident expert in teachers' sex scandals, and he's also the most intelligent voice of the New England Patriots for a firm that is chock full of people who think they know stuff about the New England Patriots. Jerry's written a couple of books, which we're going to plug at the end, and he's just an all-around great guy, and I love him. But I asked Jerry on today. I said, Jerry, what do you want to do? He said, why don't we do something about like medical practices, medicine and the history of medicine? And we decided to name this one The Twisted History of Bad Medicine. We're going to try to cover a little bit of everything, and we're going to try to jump right into it. I don't jump right into stuff right away, but we're going to do that today because why not? And I thought with medicine, we might start off with doctors. And I'm going to start with one of the guys. There's a popular, everyone on TikTok and Twitter and all the social media stuff, it's great for blurbs about stuff that had happened at one point, and you don't get anything below the surface of the story. So there was a story that I've read a couple of times on one of the social media blurbs, and I decided to do a little bit deeper dive into one of the best bad doctors of all time. The best bad doctors of all time. And it was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Robert Liston. So maybe you've heard one of the stories about him. Maybe you haven't. I really don't care. I'm going to give you all the stories about him. This was in the days before anesthesia. In the days before anesthesia, one of the most effective ways to perform any surgery was to do it as quickly as possible. To try and keep the room clean, but to try to perform the surgery as quickly as possible. Makes sense. The less time a surgery took, the less likely the patient was to bleed out, which is always a good thing, and the less time they would have to feel pain. But there was a downside to trying for surgical rapidness because accuracy would usually be sacrificed in favor of speed. It terrifies me, Jerry, to think that at some point people were doing, outside of like battlefield triage, that people were able to show up to doctor's offices in the 1800s and not expect to have anything that resembled anesthesia. So I think it would be especially terrifying then to go and the guy be like, listen, I have nothing for the pain, but what I do have is speed. And so that's what they would do to prevent blood loss, to kind of lessen the time that you would be painful on the table. So one of the most famous surgeons known for his speed was a gentleman named Dr. Robert Liston. He was known as the fastest knife on the West End, which is a great nickname for a doctor. Liston was particularly skilled at quick amputations, where most surgeons at the time lost 1 in 4 patients. They're running a mortality rate of 25%. Due to his speed and skill, Liston only lost about 1 in 10 of his amputee patients. So 10%, much better. So he had a long line of people who were lined up to get amputated by him, and the line wasn't a problem because he was pretty quick. British surgeon and author Richard Gordon, a noted Liston expert, claims that Liston could perform a leg amputation in 2.5 minutes. At one point, he'd gotten that number down to 28 seconds. 2.5 minutes. I go in for a regular colonoscopy. I've had about 8 colonoscopies, and it's an all-day affair for me, and that's just a quick camera trip up my ass. 2.5 minutes to get in and out of there without a leg is outstanding.
Yeah, and imagine, like, next time you're mad because you had like a 9:30 appointment and they don't bring you in till like 9:45. This guy's selling point was, you know, accuracy is not my thing, but I'm really fast on the draw. And that was probably on his business card, like fastest amputee doctor in the West End. And that's where we, and I would have gone to that guy.
There's no reason not to, right? If you have the connections and you have the means to do it, I would rather spend 2.5 minutes getting my leg amputated. By the way, I don't know how prevalent leg amputations were in a day. It sounds like it was like taking out a wisdom tooth, the way we're talking about it. But if I had to get my leg amputated, I'd like to have it done in 2.5 minutes. And I'd like to have it done with only a 1 in 10 chance of dying as opposed to a 1 in 4. So he did receive a tremendous amount of acclaim, and he was world famous and known as the fastest knife in the West End. But he also had a couple of operations or a couple of situations that stood above the rest when you look at his ample and famous body of work. I'm going to mention four of them. One, while amputating a patient's leg, and this is what you might have seen the snippets on social media. While amputating a patient's leg, Liston broke his personal record by finishing the surgery in 2.5 minutes. This was before the 28-second anomaly. However, in the interest of speed, he got a little too excited, and he chopped off both the patient's testicles along with his leg. So see, there is one of those things that's tough to explain when that person... And by the way, this all documented. All documented in the 1800s and whatnot. And so it is what it is. So as he's in there, I guess you just sign away everything. And in the rush to take the patient's leg off, this is bone saws. This is big time stuff. This isn't carving a turkey. This is taking off a leg. So while he was doing it in his rush, he took off both the patient's testicles.
Right. That was that period's equivalent of having an HMO.
Yes, it was.
Like, really, you should have gone for the PPO. You might have had both your balls, but you know, we're not here to take up all sorts of billable hours. Get you through, and we'll figure out your balls at some other time.
Quick, he was quick on the draw for diagnosis too. So he also once, this is the number two one, he also once mistook a lump on a young boy's neck for a skin tag, and he removed it suddenly at the boy's home. He's like, no, that thing can just come off, whisk the skin tag right away. The lump turned out to be an aneurysm of the carotid artery, and the boy bled out and died. Terrible, terrible stories. Guy lost his balls when he had to lose his leg, and then parents lost their kids when he had misdiagnosed a carotid artery aneurysm as a skin tag. Number three, he performed, this is a positive, he performed the successful removal in 4 minutes flat, Jer. 4 minutes flat of a 45-pound scrotal tumor whose owner had to carry his tumor around in a wheelbarrow. So again, 1830s. Think about that, 1830s England. Everywhere this guy went, he had a wheelbarrow in front of him with 45 pounds of testicle tumor hanging out into this thing. He goes to Dr. Liston and says, can you get rid of it? He said, not only can I get rid of it, you got 4 minutes? And boom, boom, boom. 4 minutes later, 45 pounds of tumor is taken successfully off this guy's sack. That's one of the positive ones out of the three that I just gave you. And the fourth one is the one that I think he's most known for. Liston was performing a leg amputation on a patient who was lying flat on a table. And back then, surgeries were often witnessed. There'd be a crowd of people around the surgery, they were witnessing surgeries and whatnot. It was done almost in a theater. You've seen pictures of it from the day. There was almost like a circular theater around it. So these people would kind of be right up on it. Very gory and whatnot, but it was plain old spectators, but also fellow doctors and stuff like that, because it was a good way, because there was no YouTube to YouTube leg amputations. So he's in there, patient is flat on the table. There's spectators all around him. As Liston had brought down his knife, he was so focused on his speed that he took his surgical assistant's two of her fingers off as he was taking off the patient's leg. And as he swung the knife back up, it actually clipped a spectator's coattails. And the spectator, now seeing a leg gone and fingers chopped off and being that close to being taken off by the knife too, that spectator had fainted. The patient and Liston's assistant both died of the wounds that he had caused. And the spectator who collapsed was later discovered to have died from fright. Those three deaths made Liston surgery the only surgery on record with a 300% mortality rate. One person goes in and three people go out with toe tags. So that's possibly the most famous story about Robert Liston, and for good reason. He went in to operate on a guy, remove his leg. The gentleman whose leg was removing died. Not a huge tragedy. Like I said, 1 in 10. Assistant gets the fingers cut off, and then a spectator dies of fright.
He was the Surgeon General of his time.
Absolutely. And despite his downfalls, he remained a distinguished surgeon. After his death, so this is after all this stuff was documented, his peers erected a marble statue in his honor and created an award for students of distinction in his name. This is some of the positives. He was the first professor of clinical surgery at University College in London in 1835. Stud. He performed the first public operation utilizing modern anesthesia, which was ether at the time, in 1846. So when they finally did find something to knock you out, ether was the first thing that they were using in surgeries. He was the first guy to perform an operation with ether at University College Hospital. Again, stud. He invented see-through isinglass sticking plaster. Isinglass sticking plaster has a Tolkien-type thing to it. Doesn't like Isengard. He invented the bulldog forceps, which are a type of artery forceps, I guess to kind of clamp off all these arteries as he's cutting through all these limbs. And he also created a leg splint used to stabilize dislocations and fractures of the femur. All three of those inventions are still used today. Stud. Two of Liston's students, one's name was James Simpson, would go on to be a pioneer of chloroforms used as an anesthetic. And then another one of his students, Joseph Lister, not Liston, Lister, who pioneered aseptic technique to sterilize surgical instruments and to clean wounds. You know Lister a little bit because of his antiseptic background. That Listerine, the mouthwash, antiseptic mouthwash, was named after one of Liston's students whose name was Joseph Lister. So that's the story of Robert Liston, who's known to be the best bad doctor of all time. And I think that he's one of the perfect ways to start off the twisted history of bad medicine.
Positively. And you know what? Look, I'm just a charter guest and you're the captain of this ship, but I just feel like in the current environment, it's always important to throw in a disclaimer. Mm-hmm. Like if you so much as question medical science now, there's someone who's going to jump in with so what you're saying is, you know, ism. And we're not being anti-science here. We're not being anti-medicine, right? You and I both want our friggin' vaccines as soon as we can get them, right? I mean,
yeah.
Jenny McCarthy, bless her. But you shouldn't take your medical advice from her. So, right. I think what our topic here is about is, you know, how medical science evolves. And they don't always have the answers. Just in the last year alone, they've changed their advice. So, you know, the goalposts have moved constantly. We're just saying that in the history of medicine, they don't always know.
No. And I think that it's one of those things where I've had more arguments and whatnot surrounding vaccinations and whatnot with the pandemic, particularly on blogs, than I've had in any other subject ever. I wrote a little benign blog because O.J. Simpson had gotten both shots, and both times he put it up on a social media page. And I thought that was a little cheeky of O.J. to do so.
Right.
I thought that, you know, if there's 2% of the public was going to be vaccinated for some reason. And, you know, I realize people can disagree with that. I thought that OJ probably shouldn't be in that 2% when we know so many people who could probably use it. And I pointed out one friend in particular. So it's starting to create conversations that I didn't think that I was going to have with people that I'd never, you know, care to know. I mean, not a lot of that going to be going on in this podcast, obviously, because we're going to go back and there's enough shit that goes on with history. But we also do have an unfettered trust in some of these names that are throwing us out these vaccines, like Johnny John, Johnson & Johnson, the baby shampoo and whatnot, having a vaccine out. We said, oh, it's Johnny John. Household name. What could go wrong?
Yeah, like they own the Jets. I mean,
right.
Their reputation's impeccable.
And whenever I think about that, I go back to something that we had mentioned. I don't even remember which which podcast we'd mentioned in for Twisted History, but I go back to Bear. And I don't know if I did that podcast with you, but it seems familiar to have you here. But the relationship between Bear aspirin, which, I mean, most people had in their medicine cabinet growing up, if they don't still have it now, has always fascinated me. And so I may have mentioned this before. You'll have to excuse me. I'm going to mention it again because Bayer and the Nazis have such a close relationship. It was created as an independent company, but by the 1930s, they became part of a larger German entity called IG Farben. That's what Bayer had become, IG Farben. And IG Farben was essentially like a Tyco, as a conglomerate formed by a number of major chemical companies in Germany. And as a German chemical corporation in the Nazi regime, IG Farben, as you can imagine, whenever you mention chemicals and Nazis, they committed a long list of atrocities. It was that company that developed the Zyklon B gas that was used in the Nazi death camps to kill millions and millions of Jews and other undesirables. IG Farben relied on concentration camp slave labor throughout World War II and the Holocaust. They built a factory right next door to Auschwitz and would use prisoners at the camp for slave work, often threatening their slave laborers that if you don't work faster, you'll be gassed. You'll be gassed by gas that we're making in this chemical factory next door to Auschwitz. This is IG Farben. This is Bayer's parent company. At the end of the war, IG Farben was dissolved, and the directors of the company were put on trial for war crimes. 13 of the 24 company directors, they were arraigned and convicted. 11 of them had gotten off. But of all these Nazi collaborators, right, all of them received early release. And most of them were reinstated as directors of the new corporations created out of the dissolution of IG Farben, including Bayer. Fritz Termeer, which is one of the most German names I've ever heard in my life. Fritz Termeer, who directed operations at the IG Farben plant at Auschwitz, became the president of Bayer after the war. It blows my fucking mind. They make traditional aspirin. They make Claritin. They make Alka-Seltzer. They make Aleve. They make Afrin. They make Miralax. And Bayer bought Monsanto a couple of years back, a company that was one of the first to manufacture Agent Orange, which is widely known for its use by the U.S. military for its part in chemical warfare. Operation Ranch Hand during the Vietnam War from 1961 to 1971. So this has got that stink all over it, and that's Bayer aspirin. That's, you know, like right. Alka-Seltzer is 5 feet away from me right now. So sometimes the more you know, the better off you are, or maybe not. Sometimes ignorance is bliss because Aleve works for me. Kind of gets me a little high. I like Aleve. Claritin I've been using since I was a kid. Miralax I could probably use a little bit now. But Bayer did eventually apologize for their role in the Holocaust, Jerry. But they did it in 1995.
All right. Well, you know, they said they're sorry. What more do you want? No, this is right. This has been part of the dirty deal that has marked the advance of civilization for millennia. I mean, you know, how did we get to the moon? Wernher von Braun, you know, who used like Jewish slave labor while he was working on the German rocket program, like did experiments with like, you know, prisoners in cold conditions and zero gravity or whatever he could simulate, like hyperbaric chambers with no oxygen or whatever. And, you know, when he got here, there's actually an old song by a guy named Tom Warner, I think is his name. I hope I don't get the name wrong.
Fritz Demir?
No, this guy did like comedic satirical songs back in the 60s. And he did this one about Wernher von Braun. It's in that show that had Al Pacino, the one that was on HBO, the Hunters,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where there's a line in there like, don't say that he's hypocritical. Just say that he's apolitical, Wernher von Braun. And it's fascinating. And yeah, so much of what, and it's a sick, twisted history thing, so much of what has made our life better has been the abject suffering of people that came before us. And it's just kind of this deal with the devil that we all have to, you know, wrap our brains around when we have Alka-Seltzer and some of the miracle medicines that we're going to talk about as we go forward.
Yeah, and I know that that's the case with everything too, right? There's always broken eggs in every omelet that we eat. I get it. And some of it just relies on, I don't know, Michael Jordan sneakers being made for 20 cents an hour in a sweatshop somewhere. Stuff that we kind of put we put in the back of our minds. But sometimes I like to bring stuff up to the forefront. And Bear's connection to the Nazi party is one that's an old chestnut that I like to go to. What's up, Johnny?
Quick pop culture reference. When I think of Wernher von Braun, I think of October Sky. Do you remember that movie with Jake Gyllenhaal?
Absolutely.
So it's funny. I don't know if I could Google and see if there's like articles, but I think there was a little bit of like people going cockeyed at, you know, them making him to be this like not a hero character, because I think, you know, it was more of a relationship story with his dad. But they really did glorify a little bit like Wernher von Braun in that movie. When I was younger and I read the book and everything, and I never knew the name. So I always think of October Sky, Jake Gyllenhaal, and how they made him to be like the guy. The guy who built, you know, was the face of NASA essentially in that movie.
Yep, and it was the suffering of innocent people that was part of the groundwork of us getting into space. It's like it's horrible. But you know what? Had we not gotten those Nazi scientists out first, the Soviets would have gotten them, and they would have gotten the bomb first. I mean, it's horrible. Like, history is a complete cluster fudge, and we are standing on that toxic waste dump, like trying to make a nice life for ourselves.
Right. And for people who know, as long as we're talking about history and Jake Gyllenhaal, he was also in a movie as a gay cowboy. Never forget. That's bravery. Yeah, I wish I could. Yeah. That's how I feel every time I ask you to come back on the show, Jerry. I wish I could quit you.
Anytime you want to go up to the Rockies. Yep. Wear cowboy hats and play out that fantasy.
That would be a tough receipt to hand in, wouldn't it? Like, we'd have to split up all, you know what I mean? I'll do the grease, but you do the satin sheets. Like, we'd have to hand all those into Erica and whatnot. Be kind of weird.
We need one sleeping bag.
Yeah. I'm going to mention a bunch of stuff that's going to be weird from people who create chemicals and whatnot. But before I do that, I'm going to give you somebody who's very, very positive. I went out and took my dog for a walk the other day, Jerry. We're walking down my block, just my block in suburban New Jersey. We went down the block and around, me and my Welsh Terrier O'Shea. This is what I saw on the way. 6 or 7 bottle caps from Twisted Teas. The Twisted Teas, the hard eye teas. I saw them maybe like 3 or 4 houses down to me, the bottle caps on the ground. As I walked around the corner, the kids who were just drinking them on the way were just throwing them on the front lawn. So I probably saw, including my front lawn, so there's probably 4 or 5 dead soldiers with Twisted Teas around. On the next block over, there was a single baby shoe just in the middle of the drive. Like, the kid must have kicked off his shoe, but it's just playing into my mind about this party that was going on in northern New Jersey. When I come all the way back around to my house, before I get to my house, maybe 4 or 5 houses down, there's an empty envelope package of 3 Chi gummies. And I couldn't have been more proud, because I think I might have brought it to this neighborhood. And 3 Chi is something we're going to talk about now. It's 3-CHI, pronounced 3 Chi. They're the leader in Delta 8 THC products. We talked about it before. CBD doesn't do much. Straight up Delta 9 from pot does a little bit too much for me. Delta 8 hits you right in the middle. I get anxiety whenever I'm anywhere around a pot product. This does not give me that anxiety. It makes every movie, including Jake Gyllenhaal cowboy movies, just uber enjoyable. So what we do, Annie and I do, is that we do the gummies, 25 milligram Delta 8 gummies. But you can also do the vapes, the tinctures, the oils that you can use to make cookies and whatnot, all of it. The only caveat, you need to be 21 or older to purchase it, but otherwise it's federally legal in the United States, and you have to go to 3chi.com, the number 3chi.com, and pick up these Delta 8 gummies that I'm telling you about, and you're going to use the code TWISTED2021, a long code, at checkout to receive 5% off your order. So that's 3chi.com, the number 3chi.com, and you're going to use the code TWISTED2021 at checkout for 5% off your order, and use that. And I'm telling you, it makes everything a little bit better. So 3Chi, that's one of the big sponsors for today, as usual. They're very, very good with our podcast. But so from that, we're going to move on to something more specific medicinally. We're going to talk about some drugs and whatnot, and most of them on how they came to be, these household names, and how they came to be, for the most part, and it's just the ones that we happen to cherry pick for today. And again, Annie did almost all the research for today. She did another great job, as always, St. Anne. But most of them kind of came to us on accident. And the first one's a biggie. I think when people think what's the most useful medicine that you can have, most people agree it's penicillin. I mean, I kind of think it's anesthesia now after reading about Robert Liston. But penicillin has always kind of been number one with a bullet for me since I was able to understand what medicine was about. Ancient cultures, including those in Egypt, Greece, and India, independently discovered the useful properties of fungi and plants in treating infection. These treatments often worked because many organisms, including many species of mold, naturally produce antibiotic substances. So you hear about all this stuff about, I don't know why I'm going back to Tolkien, but somebody takes a little foxglove, chews on it, and puts it on Aragorn's wounds. Or you hear about all these Native, I don't know why I'm using a mythological being. You see Native Americans who go out and they, you see the witches. We did a big thing on witches in and around Halloween and where some of their brews have been made up. Particularly from vegetation and mold, you get antibiotic substances. And antibiotic substances from mold is what eventually caused the discovery of penicillin. In 17th century Poland, so a long time ago, wet bread was mixed with spider webs. That sounds like a real witch's brew, right? Like Eye of Newt, Leg of Toad. Wet bread was mixed with spider webs, which contain fungal spores, to treat wounds. And it worked. In England, in 1640, which I guess is also the 17th century, the idea of using mold as a form of medical treatment was recorded by apothecaries such as John Parkinson, King's Herbarium, who advocated the use of mold in his book on pharmacology. I read that a little bit incorrectly, but there's a guy named John Parkinson who wrote a book called King's Herbarium, and it advocated the use of mold in his book of pharmacology. So mold has always kind of been on the menu for medicinal purposes. But ancient practitioners could not precisely identify nor isolate the active components in the mold they used, so the penicillin within was just being used through blind luck, essentially. Penicillin was officially discovered in 1929 by a gentleman called Sir Alexander Fleming, a Scottish physician and microbiologist who in 2009 was voted the third greatest Scot behind poet Robert Burns, who was number one, and William Wallace, who everyone knows as Braveheart. So the guy who created...
Ahead of Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Who's ahead of Rowdy Roddy Piper.
All right.
He's ahead of Annie's favorite guy, the guy who played Leonidas in the 300.
Oh, Gerard Butler.
Yeah, I know that.
I'm with her. He's a dreamboat.
He's a dreamboat. Sean
made a
Connery.
Lot of crap movies, but Sean Connery, sure. Okay.
I can't think. What other Scots am I in love with? What other famous guy? I'm surprised that the guy who invented penicillin was behind Robert Burns. Not to put Robert Burns down, but poetry's poetry. Penicillin's fucking penicillin. Braveheart was a great movie, but penicillin has saved hundreds of millions of lives. But, you know, Luke Evans, another great actor. Scottish dude. Tommy Flanagan, the dude with the scars on his face from Braveheart, right? He's like Braveheart's right-hand man. All Scots, I believe.
Groundskeeper Willie,
another one.
Ewan McGregor, outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. So before he discovered penicillin, this guy, Sir Alexander Fleming, in 1921, while researching bacteria and antibacterial substances, Sir Alexander Fleming, used snot, nasal mucus, to plates contaminated with bacteria, and he found that the mucus inhibited bacterial growth. So he was one of the first guys that was able to use stuff that naturally came from your body to see if that could fight off bacteria. He extended his test to using tears, which were contributed by his coworkers. For 6 weeks, if you worked in Sir Alexander Fleming's lab, you were using. They made you suck on lemons and smell onions, and your tears were harvested for research, for his experiments. He then went on to test with saliva, cartilage, blood, semen, which was also a very interesting 6 weeks, ovarian cyst fluid, yikes, pus, and egg white all showed that the same bacterial agent was present in every one of these fluids. So that was one of his first claim to fame, Sir Alexander Fleming. He found natural antibacterial properties in bodily fluids. The agent that he was looking at later became known as lysozyme. It's an antimicrobial enzyme produced by animals that forms part of our innate immune system. That's the first thing that Fleming had discovered. Years later, in 1928, so this is fast forwarding about 7 years from the lysozyme, he was investigating the properties of staphylococci, right, of a bacterial infection. And he had gone home for the weekend, so he left his lab at St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London for a few weeks, and he went on vacation. And he returned to find the dishes, the Petri dishes that he used, growing bacteria and mold. And when he observed this mold, where the mold had grown was clear of bacteria, as if the bugs had been destroyed by something on the growth. So we already knew there was some sort of antibacterial within bodily fluids. Now he's seeing that some sort of mold also was good in killing bacteria. Fleming then grew the mold in a pure culture and found that the culture broth contained an antibacterial substance that affected bacteria such as staphylococci and pathogens that caused scarlet fever, which you don't hear about nowadays, but that was killing a shitload of people back in the day, pneumonia, meningitis, diphtheria, and one of your favorites, Jerry, gonorrhea, right? No shortage of jokes on gonorrhea.
Not anymore.
Congratulations.
Johnny, keep your gun clean. No. Yeah.
So after months of calling it mold juice, which didn't really sell well.
Marketing sat down with him and said, you know what, we're gonna change mold juice.
And they changed the name from mold juice to the inhibitor. But it wound up that was already a popular name of a dildo. So they had to change the name once, and I made that up. They had to change the name once again from mold juice to the inhibitor to something called penicillin on March 7th, 1929 for the antibacterial substance present in the mold. There was some sort of like penicillium or whatever. So it was called penicillin.
Penicillin notatum.
There it was, penicillin notatum.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if I can elaborate on this a little bit before we move on.
Please.
And not only did this come about as a result that Fleming was genius, but also a total slob that pissed off everybody in the lab because he would leave Petri dishes lying around and go on vacation. There were such a confluence of things that all came together to make this perfect conditions. One was there was a lab downstairs from where he kept this stuff out, where they were using that penicillin notatum spores. They made their way up from that lab. And two, there was an unusual cold spell in London. So it created this, God, I hate this cliche, but I'm going to use it, this perfect storm of conditions so that this thing that has probably saved, you said hundreds of millions. I think that the estimated number is 200 million lives from this that complained completely by accident. And if he was the kind of guy who put his Petri dishes in the dishwasher, like 200 million people are dead today.
Right. And so what it is, these happy mistakes, and some of them are probably inevitabilities. We're going to talk about a lot of happy mistakes today. Some of them are probably inevitabilities that someone was going to find these out. But this one did seem like it was just a product of somebody's slovenliness. By the way, we've been on for about 25 minutes or so before a guy from New England mentioned the perfect storm. The Flemish cap has to come up just, I mean.
We're Gloucestermen. We go where the fish are. Yeah. Large, the first thing you do, you come out of the harbor, you wave at the lighthouse keeper's kid. By the way, lighthouses haven't had keepers in about 100 years, but you do you, George Clooney. Jesus.
So he does this all around 1929. But little to no attention was paid of his discovery. Why is that? Because the difficulty of producing penicillin in large amounts or isolating the main compound was a real pain in the balls, and they weren't able to do it correctly or at least efficiently. But these guys were biochemists. They weren't the type of people that could take it to the next level. So the discovery of penicillin kind of just floundered, is another nautical term, after the fish, for about a decade. Right? In the 1930s. And then comes along Howard Florey. and he took a team of people from Oxford. He took Fleming's little-known paper on penicillin, and he realized the mold's potential. Florey and his team of Oxford scientists were able to isolate and produce it more efficiently, and their work is estimated, as Jerry had said, to save up to close to 250 million lives, a quarter of a billion lives. Wide-scale production of penicillin didn't come till much later. And so it was discovered, then it kind of be brought into production, but widespread production wasn't possible till much later. Penicillin was so scarce after Florey and his team had found out just how useful it was that before 1944, it was extracted from treated patients' urine to be reused. So if you were treated with penicillin, they would then harvest your urine and then extract the penicillin back out to be used on somebody else. So recycled penicillin was a thing in 1944. And here's a final penicillin fact. This is one of those ones that I would do on the Twisted History TikTok. It was by lucky chance that we tested penicillin on mice instead of guinea pigs. We hear about lab rats and guinea pigs all the time. Guinea pigs, unlike other rodents or unlike other animals, have a different type of bacterial flora, gut flora, as it were. And their gut flora would not have reacted to penicillin the way yours does or regular lab mouse was. So if they used guinea pigs, there's a good chance that the penicillin just wouldn't have worked and would have been shelled as an ineffective drug. But since they used it on white mice, it was realized, and then the rest is history with what the drug has done for us so far.
And I'll just end with this. The antibiotics were actually a huge factor in winning World War II. Because the Allies were so far ahead, thanks to the things you're talking about and extracting urine or whatever you mentioned, 1944, a lot of soldiers that otherwise would have died from infection on the good guys' side survived, and the Nazis didn't have this technology because they were too busy working on Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Aleve. One of the things that jumps to mind, too, as far as medicines go, is I think just because the fact diabetes runs in the family is insulin. Like insulin is also something that's a household name. Easy to say that insulin is a household name. I find that the insulin story is one of those ones that's a quick hit, too. In 1922, at the University of Toronto, scientists went to a hospital. I love the theatrics of this. Scientists went to a hospital in 1922. We know what it was like living in 1922. It wasn't easy. They went to a hospital in the University of Toronto where children who were comatose and dying from ketoacidosis were being held. So imagine walking into a room full of parents that were just sitting at multiple little cot bedsides waiting for the inevitable death of their comatose child. Right? Like we kind of, I don't know, we liken it maybe to when Vito Corleone came over and you kind of see what his conditions were when he was put in quarantine, right? When he came over for The Godfather. I always kind of hearken back to that when I think about it, or I go right to insane asylums. But 1922 at the University of Toronto, having a bunch of kids who are in comas and dying from diabetic ketoacidosis. So the scientists went from bed to bed. Came in, all these parents are with their kids, and they're basically saying their last goodbyes. I know I'm making it probably a little bit more dramatic, but that's what we do here, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah, dying children, you don't need to, right. You know, lay on the... The extra layers of pathos right. Here. I mean, they're just dying children.
Yeah.
Lighten up.
Yeah, the scientists were all wearing matching Dickies and very cravats, I think they were called at the time.
And so then Patch Adams came in with a clown nose and right, everybody yeah. healed.
Oh, Captain, my Captain, these scientists came in, they went from bed to bed and injected each child with a new purified extract that was found called insulin. So once they got to the final child, right, the first child began to awaken. And one by one, all of the children who were dying in these comas awoke from the diabetic comas, and a room full of death and gloom became a place of joy and health. And that was at the University of Toronto in 1922. I think that's just a good story. And it's a true story, but it's one of the ways that insulin was found to work, particularly on people who are in diabetic comas. Not too bad, right? I weave a nice yarn, but that one is true, Jer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You really built us up, and right. you brought us down, and then you built us back up again. That was a beautiful tale.
In fact, that one was for me.
That would have had me crying in Fleming's lab.
Thank you. That one was for me. This one's more for you. Viagra. Viagra was never intended to treat problems in the bedroom. Viagra, that little blue pill. Show us yours now, Jer. In the early 90s.
I actually need the antidote. Because at this point, erections are doing me no good. Like it's just a perfectly good waste of blood. So yeah.
People don't know this. Jerry Thornton, great dick guy. When I first met you, I almost hung my coat on it. But Viagra was never intended to treat problems in the bedroom, as we know about it now, as being an erectile dysfunction drug. In the early 90s, so this is recent, scientists were actually developing it as a remedy for the heart condition angina, which always made me giggle, because it seemed to boost blood flow through damaged arteries by dilating blood vessels in and around the heart. Patients, however, reported an unexpected side effect, involuntary erections, some lasting 4 hours or more. It's been reported that some patients even refused to hand their pills back at the end of the angina experiment because they were enjoying their newfound erection so much.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit, it failed as an angina drug.
Right.
And in these clinical trials, they'll say, all right, well, it's not working. Can you please send it back? And nobody was sending theirs back. And that's how they discovered what it was good at, because they reached out to like the people they had sent the samples to and said, you can keep it if you want, but why are you keeping it? And they said, a cat couldn't scratch this thing. You know, there were retirees just going like, check out this. It's a hat rack at this point. So, totally accidental.
Right. So I think it's fair to say what was originally aimed at angina was redirected toward the vagina. Yeah. See what I did there?
No big deal.
And now the drug is so popular that Viagra and other erectile dysfunction pills account for 8 in 10 of illicit medicine confiscations. Like, I think that's outside of painkillers. But if people are confiscating illegal medicines, like stuff being produced outside of painkillers, erectile dysfunction drugs account for 8 out of 10 that are confiscated.
And they're the leading cause of commercials where a couple is sitting outside on a hill in claw bathtubs.
Yes.
No one's ever explained the claw bathtub thing to me. Like, why would you go out on a hill? Yeah. Why would you sit in tubs that way?
But
it's got to do with the boners.
When you have to explain something, it means maybe you should never know. Claw bathrooms are a big go-to for me, Jack. I don't mind telling you. So here's some of the other ways that Viagra's been used. Israeli and Australian, usually nothing in common, Israeli and Australian researchers found that 1 milligram of Viagra dissolved in a vase can double the shelf life of cut flowers. Kind of makes sense, right? In 2007, Argentinian studies showed that Viagra helped reset a hamster's circadian rhythm faster, his sleep-wake cycle. So they think that Viagra, as a result, is a great cure for jet lag. Environmental benefits. Since Viagra and other erectile dysfunction treatments have come on the market, the demand for parts from exotic and endangered animals appear to have dropped, even among people loyal to Chinese traditional medicine. We hear all these horror stories about sharks being, or rhinoceri being taken down for just their horns, sharks having their fins done and kind of thrown away. Sometimes you'll get like a good Brian Gumbel documentary on that. That shit's gone down because the ancient Chinese secrets that may or may not have worked when Viagra is kind of batting at least 750. So as a result, sharks and rhinoceri, they're benefiting from Viagra also. During the war in Afghanistan, the CIA discovered Viagra was the perfect incentive to motivate local tribal chiefs who often had much younger wives or more than one wife to satisfy. So one packet of 4 Viagra pills was almost guaranteed to lead to invaluable details of Taliban supply routes and movements. If you got these guys over in Afghanistan who have a bunch of young chippies at home, who need to be taken care of. I know that's sexist, but Afghanistan's a little bit sexist. You could just offer them a couple of boner pills, and all of a sudden they start pointing out the rat holes. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Give them that Dr. Porkenheimer's boner juice
right
from SNL.
Yeah. Viagra and other similar drugs have been used to help create people with severe Raynaud's syndrome by increasing blood flow to the body's extremities. We have a couple of friends who suffer from it, and you'd mentioned that Robbie is one of the guys that also has it, Robbie Fox, which I didn't know. And then finally for Viagra, Argentinian research has shown, this is the second Argentinian research with Viagra, apparently they have a lot of it down there, inconclusively, that sildenafil, which is the active ingredient in Viagra, lowers lung pressure and has been shown to enable exercise in low oxygen conditions or at high altitude. So it's one of those things that promotes working out at high altitudes. So in early 2017, the Argentine soccer team tried to get ahead by taking a cocktail of sildenafil, commercially known as Viagra, caffeine, and aspirin for its World Cup qualifying match against Bolivia. Bolivia instead decided to use a more traditional route and just get high on cocaine. A match was played in La Paz, which was 3,600 meters above sea level, and that's why we called it inconclusive, because Argentina had lost that match to Bolivia by a score of 2-0. So that's Viagra, which was also one of these happy little accidents. I'm going to keep going. Quinine, right? Like a tonic. One of the main drugs used to combat malaria, a disease that kills 1 million people a year. I didn't know that. Malaria is still killing a lot of people, particularly in Africa, up to 1 million people a year. And it was also found by complete accident. Legend has it a South American native suffering from malaria and desperate to quench his thirst drank from a bitter tasting pool of water that was high in the Andes. Next to the pool were some cinchona trees, the bark of which turned out was packed with quinine. When the man's fever broke and others began using the tree as medicine, it eventually became a major weapon against the deadly disease. So simply drinking something that happened to be near a pool, that happened to be near the bark, that happened to be an unrefined source of quinine. Am I pronouncing that right?
I think it's quinine, but I'm
quinine.
Not gonna,
I think you're right. It doesn't sound correct to me. Yeah. Because it was a tonic, like quinine. I remember it, but yeah, so it's quinine. I said quinine. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and I know at one point they had gotten malarial deaths down to almost nothing in Africa, but it was through DDT, which was killing people in another way. So they stopped dropping DDT to kill the mosquitoes, and the deaths went right back up. So it's, you know, if quinine can save lives without dumping a bunch of poison into the water supply or whatever, then everybody's winning.
Right. Jerry, I'm going to talk to you about this next one. It's something that I always wondered about. Andy and I were talking about it the other day. Rogaine, right? So Rogaine, obviously I'm stone bald. I'm, you know, I shave the head every day. It grows back. It's very sparse. It's a not a well-attended party up top, but it's something that I never tried. Rogaine, a major treatment for male hair loss, actually began as a tablet for high blood pressure. When researchers were testing out Rogaine on patients, they began to notice some of these patients were sprouting hairs on their head, their hands, and their neck. Not necessarily good. So a drug meant to lower blood pressure was dilating blood vessels. And courtesy of the side effects, it was then reformulated into an over-the-counter lotion to cure hair loss. You got a full head of hair, Jer. Have you had any help with that, or are you all 100% Jerry Thornton up there?
Yeah, this is just genetics. It turns gray prematurely. I got this from my dad, but it's never gonna go out. And I've wondered, like, what's it? When did you start to lose yours?
So I started to lose my hair very young. I started to lose my hair in my 20s. But what happened was I was losing it where the part of my hair was. So it was almost like a pizza wedge that started to get bigger and bigger. So what I did was I started to part my hair to the other side.
Right.
Then I started using something called a botifying mist. And then I said, what am I doing? I'm 29 or something like that. So I wound up just shaving it. And I happen to be a guy who has a beautiful head. Like, I don't know how you'd look. It kind of scares me to think about it. But I don't know how you would look with a shaved head.
Yeah.
I think John probably has a nice head, even though he has a full head of hair, beautiful head of hair. But from what I understand, that one of the first things they do when you get a Hollywood agent is they put you on Rogaine. Like, they say that the percentage of actors, working actors in Hollywood, who take some sort of, and I don't know what's the one that they take instead of Rogaine, perhaps there's something else, minoxidil. I think is one of the technical or chemical forms of it. It's given almost like a starter pack for all actors and whatnot.
But is it really effective? It always seemed to me like that was just snake oil.
Francis was a guy that I respected a lot, and John used to do a ton of work with him. And Francis
is great, yeah.
Yeah, greatest guy in the world. He's still with us, by the way, but he's still working and alive and well. We're talking about
sure, it. Sure, like, no, absolutely.
Yeah, were you eulogizing?
Oh, no, I said, you know, present tense. He's a great guy. Yeah, absolutely.
Smelting accident, though, is what I was kind of getting at. But I think he had used one. One of the Roman. No free ads, but here you go. So Roman has a minoxidil-ish type product for hair loss, and Francis had used it and said that it worked out. And I think he used it after the pushing of his agent. So I think it's one of those things where if people can tell me it's snake oil, everyone says I'm too far gone. I'm too far. I'm in the abyss, right? One foot in the grave, the other on a banana peel. So just give it up.
See, I'm a big believer that a man can do two things with his hair. One is cut it, and the other is shave it off. Like, you see a guy with a completely bald, shaved head, it takes you 10 seconds to go, all right, well, that's just him. Whatever, Bruce Willis, you know? You don't obsess over the fact that he has no hair, but it's when you start, like, if I were ever to color it, I would just be putting a target on myself. Look at me. I'm a vain, vapid clown. No, I worked with older guys who used to color theirs, and it was like, it would be different every day, and you could tell that they were doing it. It's like, dude, you came in to work, it was white last week, and now it's jet black. It's like blue black, like Superman black, and I'm supposed to pretend that you're not putting goop in your hair. So, I sympathize with guys who lose it, but my dad was pure white hair, and he was all man, and he won World War II by himself. So I just said, I'm just going to let it go, baby. But if you're bald, let it shine. You're a good-looking cat. You have a nice-looking head. Like you said, probably like a newborn baby.
Yeah.
I think you can still
see the forceps marks. But even like some guys, I know the back of some guys' necks look like a package of Franks.
Yeah.
And it's just like unfortunate, but you're right. And I know a lot of guys who didn't go, you know, softly into the night as far as graying went. So they'd go into the weekend, salt and pepper. They'd come back on Monday and they look like Vijay Singh. Like, it was one of those things where it's like, you're not fooling anybody. But I think the hair transplant, which I don't know much about, and including today, we're not going to find out much about it, did wonders for Dave. I mean, you know, if you want to see a living, breathing poster for that shit, I mean, Dave, when you do the before and after for him, he's a reality show, just about every sense of the word.
You know what I don't understand either is the guys who do two-tone, like their beard is different than their hair color.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't even remember what is more common, but it's like brown hair or white beard or brown beard and white hair. That is bizarre to me. I think if you go dye your hair, you got to dye the beard too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the absolute worst thing you can do is try to hide the bald spots. Stop. Gentlemen, if you're watching this podcast and you're starting to lose it, let it go. A while ago, I was at Mass, and they had the guys from the Knights of Columbus there, and they're wearing like the HMS Pinafore hats or whatever, and they all take their hats off and put them over their hearts, and the guy next to me just started flailing. And I looked, and like, what is going on with this guy? And the reason is, as soon as he took off his lid, this comb went straight up like a rooster's, like, coxcomb or whatever they call that thing. And I'm just like, dude, just let it shine. Take it off. Like, you're not fooling anybody. When I'm at a 45 degree angle from what you see in the mirror, I'm laughing at you. So just, gentlemen, just it going bald is there's no sin in that. So just let it go.
It's three men on this day. It's only one of them is handsome and the other two are doing all the talk about losing their hair. You know what I mean? John, you're a handsome guy. It's just the way that it is. I want to move on to another one that I think we all love, nitrous oxide. Laughing gas. Don't give it out as much as they should, but it used to be one of those things. As soon as you got into the chair at the dentist, he could say you have sensitive gums. They give it to you for a cleaning. It's the greatest thing in the world. It's been used as an anesthetic for over 150 years, but it was first discovered, this is fucking wild, in 1793. 1793 is when they had first discovered nitrous oxide, but no one realized that it could block pain. it was only used as a drug for all intents and purposes. Traveling circus shows used to make money from customers who would pay to inhale nitrous oxide before they would go in and watch the show. Comedy shows, traveling shows, circus shows, freak shows, all that kind of stuff. You'd be able to buy a couple of puffs of nitrous oxide, sort of like I do with 3G, and you'd enjoy the show more immensely. It wasn't until 1844, but we're still talking a long time ago, that an American dentist called Horace Wells was at one of these shows in Connecticut when he noticed a man who cut his leg falling from the stage felt absolutely no pain until his giggle gas had worn off. The next day, Wells had gone to his practice and experimented with the gas while having one of his teeth removed, paving the way for a breakthrough in pain control. So nitrous oxide started as a way to make a circus more palatable, and it ended as one of the more effective pain inhibitors in the history of modern medicine, which is kind of cool. And I didn't know this. So I'm hoping that, and maybe this is redundant for some, but we're going to try to get to a bunch of it just so you guys know how these things had come across. By pure chance led to discovery of the heart drug Digitalis, which we also see oftentimes advertised during a daytime TV. It's a heart remedy that was used for nearly 200 years until newer drugs came along. In 1776, country doctor William Withering said there was nothing he could do for a woman dying of dropsy, which you don't hear about either. It's a swelling of body tissues due to an ailing heart. He had later heard she had recovered after taking a remedy made from a garden plant called foxglove, which I had mentioned earlier in the podcast, foxglove. Scientists later found foxglove, which is poisonous in high doses. It got rid of its excess fluid, and it turned it into a heart drug that was then used for nearly 200 years called Digitalis. So Digitalis was found from the herb called foxglove. Has a small familiarity to you, right? The word foxglove, Jer?
Yeah, I just only in the context that you're using it. Like, I wouldn't know if there's one growing in my backyard, but I've heard of it as like a remedy. You know, you mentioned Lord of the Rings earlier. That's like Wolfsbane.
Wolfsbane, yeah,
is what they
exactly
put in a Nazgul blade in Frodo's shoulder or whatever. Don't right. Take me down that path. Like,
no,
you'll never shut me up about Tolkien.
I hear you. By the way, they released all those since there's no new movies coming out. Well, there are now, but a lot of these like IMAX theaters are doing those things now in the new Dolby IMAX for the first time, and I'm tempted just to bang out an absolute marathon, see the three original Lord of the Rings movies.
Right.
So that's a little peek.
Give me that extended director's cut, and I'm with you. I want all 12 and a half hours.
Yeah,
absolutely, bring
hours.
That shit on.
New York engineer Wilson Greatbatch, great name, invented the world's first implantable heart pacemaker, but he didn't mean to. He was trying to build a device to record heartbeats in 1956, just to give some sort of record of how people's arrhythmia was. He accidentally installed the wrong type of resistor into his prototype, which promptly began to emit regular electrical pulses. So what was started as a counting thing started to become a shocking thing. Realizing that these pulses were recapitulating the electrical activity of a normal heartbeat, Greatbatch immediately saw the potential of his device. After 2 years of refinements, his design for a pacemaker that could be implanted into the heart was patterned in 1960 and soon went into production. Life-saving descendants of this first device now improved the lives of over 500,000 patients with slow heartbeats every year. So that was a happy accident where a guy put in something to sort of measure your heartbeat and said he started shocking people. Stomach ulcers. We'd mentioned this. Stomach ulcers was something that everyone suffered from when I was a kid. Oh, he had an ulcer you could throw a softball through. You don't hear about it too much anymore.
Right. And it was always caused by stress. Like, you watch, I don't know, 60 sitcoms, and the guy's always having an ulcer because he's so stressed out from work. Seriously, when was the last time you heard about somebody saying, the boss is really riding me. My ulcers are acting up. And then for a while there, it was bad backs.
Yeah, everyone had a bad back from it.
From stress. Now, yeah. I don't know what we have. We have pill addictions.
In the 1980s, two Australian doctors were ridiculed for suggesting that stomach ulcers were not caused by business lunches and stress and things that we had seen in 1980 sitcoms, but by infection with a common bacteria. So this is what happened to it. So instead of the stressful thing, oh, you're giving me ulcers, you're giving me agita. Barry Marshall, a gastroenterologist, and his pathologist colleague in Perth by the name of Robert Warren, noticed that stomach biopsies taken from their ulcer patients all contain the spiral-shaped bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. Nailed that.
Helicobacter pylori. Yeah.
So to prove their hunch, to put their money where their mouth is literally, Marshall deliberately downed a pint of foaming Helicobacter broth that he had grown in his lab after isolating it from the stomach of one of his patients. I'll say that again. So this guy was convinced that it wasn't from stress and shit, that ulcers were caused by the Helicobacter pylori. So he went, he synthesized a pint glass filled with a broth of Helicobacter pylori, and he downed it. This was synthesized from the stomachs of one of his ulcer patients. Within a week of downing this Helicobacter pylori broth, which sounds like some Indian dish, within a week he had rampant stomach inflammation.
Shocking.
The beginning of ulcers, which he then completely reversed by taking antibiotics. That is some World War Z shit, right? Like, that's, you know, Brad Pitt giving himself the hantavirus, fucking around with the Coke machine, zombies all run by, then he goes out, cures himself, and cures the rest of the world. So this was done by a guy I've never heard of before, but got huge balls. He's an Australian gastroenterologist named Barry Marshall, along with his buddy Robert Warren. Their discovery meant the virtual eradication of a type of stomach cancer. On top of curing what's known as the common ulcer, it also caused the eradication of a type of stomach cancer caused by the Helicobacter pylori infection. And for their work, they were awarded the 2005 Nobel Peace Prize for Medicine. Nobel Prize for Medicine. Fucking studs.
So it's the least you can do for a guy who drinks the contents of another man's stomach in the name of science.
Yeah. We don't see enough of that in this day and age, Jer.
In the future, you might want to go straight to the antibiotics and skip the stomach bile. But, you know, how weird is that? Because what were they doing in the Middle Ages? Everything was about bile. They thought bile was the cause of all your ailments, and getting your biles properly balanced were the key to good health. And now, you know, in the 21st century, there's a guy drinking somebody's stomach contents and winning a Nobel Prize.
But it's the exact answer to your question about what happened to them, what happened to ulcers. And I know there's a degree of ulceritis, there's all different types, and I'm sure stress is a major contributor to it. So if there are doctors who are listening to this, why are you listening to this? This is fucking insulting to you. But we're just talking about these two gentlemen in particular, and it's kind of a studly thing. This one's not as exciting, but sucralose. In 1976, chemist Shashikant Fadness, there's no way I got that right, Shashikant Fadness was asked to test a chlorinated sugar compound that was being investigated as a possible insecticide. So I'm thinking that he had a problem with the language. I don't mean to put words in Mr. Fadness's mouth, Shashikant Fadness, but he was asked to test a chlorinated sugar compound that was supposed to be used as an insecticide. Fadness's English wasn't that good, so he thought he'd been asked to taste this chlorinated sugar compound. So he did taste it, and he found it to be super sweet. So they wound up not being a great insecticide, but Shashikant Fadness had said, but it was good. It was very sweet. I mean, I could see it. So leading sucralose to no longer being tested as an insecticide, but instead as an artificial sweetener, which is now marketed as Splenda. So that's how Splenda came into the market. I think that's a cute little
thing. Like, they wanted him to look at it under a microscope or put it in a spectrometer or whatever, and he just slammed it down and made a great decision.
I'd like to think. I have an idea what the guy looks like in my head, but when they said, no taste, test, you know, it just makes me laugh. I'm going to go from there, and this is just a small ad. It's the last one in the show. But the Barstool store. Barstool Store is now offering hoodies that are better than ever. We decided to do this crossover hoodie with a brand called UNRL, sort of like Unreal, UNRL. And it's one of the highest quality sweatshirts that we've ever ordered, and it's guaranteed to be your absolute new go-to sweatshirts. So you can go to the Barstool store, get the UNRL hoodie. There's some crossover work that they've done with the Spit and Chiclet guys and with the Foreplay guys. You can get a navy, tan, gray, black, all at the stores. So go to store.barstoolsports.com. You can get it. I just looked at them. They go to up to size 3XL, so they're going to fit even the fattest people. And while you're at the store, obviously you can look for the Twisted History t-shirt. And John and I spoke with Pilar up on 3 today. We're doing the concert t-shirt. Jerry, you're actually on it. Where we're going to have the list of the highlighted stuff that we did. I don't know which one we choose from you, but it's going to be like concert dates. So it'll be like Twisted History of Butterfly Effect with Jerry Thornton, Twisted History of Heisman's with Casey Smith, Twisted History of Kamikazes with Vibs. Everyone who we've had like probably about 13 or 14 different hosts as we've done about 60 of these shows so far. Twisted History of 9/11 with Annie, which is some people consider our best show ever. So all those ones will be listed as a concert date. And then this, what I call iconic, by the way, I'm calling it the iconic tour because I use that word so much. And then the front will just have the TH, but I think we're going to do it either in bones or in blood. You know how Twisted Sister used to switch it up?
Right.
So that's one that's hitting the store too. So I just decided to give it a little extra to this Barstool Store ad. But what they want us to push is this UNRL sweatshirts. They're incredibly comfortable. They're the highest quality sweatshirts we ever offered inside the Barstool Store. So go ahead and pick one up today at store.barstoolsports.com.
And, you know, as we start to wrap up while you grab a sip of water, I just, if I can connect a couple of dots here, just to explain how we stand on the shoulders of giants medically. So Antoni van Leeuwenhoek, the Dutch inventor, businessman, self-taught like genius from the late 1700s, and again, pioneered the microscope. He wanted to know why peppercorns were hot. And he thought, if I look at them under my microscope, I'm going to see like little spikes or something that hit your taste buds. What he saw was what he called thousands of minuscule animals crawling around on the surface of it, which we know today as bacteria. Mm-hmm. But nobody really picked up that bacteria ball and ran with it until like Louis Pasteur. We all know, you know, the pasteurization process or whatever. He used the idea of like heating. Bacteria lives between 40 and 140 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, they take milk and they heat it above 140 and it kills it, and then they cool it back off again. He used that to treat typhoid, pneumonia, and you can thank him for this, John, gonorrhea. congrats on that. So fast forward a few more years, a guy named Paul Ehrlich, who is this Jewish scientist, he was studying these things, bacteria, and he found that there was you could see it better under a microscope if he used dye. This dye was called methylene blue, which is like comes from a residue of like coal tar or whatever. Well, he saw that it had certain effects when he studied things, including like a frog that had a parasitic infection got healthy. Then he treated a sailor that had malaria. Found out that these chemicals have a benefit that nobody understood. So he started doing chemical therapy, which became known as
chemotherapy. Right.
From using a blue dye. Yeah. And all right, so, and then I'll go maybe wrap up with this.
No, you can go as much as you want, Joe. That's the reason why I have you on. Sure.
Well, the Allied ships, after they had liberated Italy in World War II, were all docked at this place called Bari, Italy, this port. And the Luftwaffe came in and attacked them. Hundreds are killed in the explosions. The explosions went from ship to ship. The ones that weren't killed jumped overboard into the water. And you can imagine what the scene was in the water. It was like, you know, covered with oil and whatever that had come out of the explosions or whatever. And so the U.S. sent this lieutenant colonel named Stuart Alexander, who just happened to be an expert in chemical weapons. So he goes there and he starts treating these patients to find out what is wrong with them, because what kept happening with them is they didn't complain about being in any kind of pain, but they were really like kind of apathetic and lethargic or whatever. So they would say, you know, I'm feeling okay, kind of like the human equivalent of that dog in the burning house meme. You know, this is fine. And then they would drop dead. So we did autopsies on, I think, like 83 of them or so. And what he found was they had this, like, a dramatic reduction in white cells. And because he was a genius in chemical weapons, he figured out that it was there was mustard gas on the British ships. And the mustard gas residue that was in the water elevated their white cell counts, which became really handy when they developed Mustargen, and it was the first cancer treatment of chemotherapy. All because the Luftwaffe attacked these ships and the British had stuff on board that had been banned in World War One. But I'm not going to complain, because if you're undergoing chemo right now, you have those guys' death to thank for it.
Absolutely. Stuart Francis Alexander, proud son of Park Ridge, New Jersey, by the way. I mean, if you're going to throw out the Flemish cap, I gotta
shut the front door. Really?
Yeah, Park Ridge, New Jersey. Yeah. But if you look at Stuart Alexander, if you try to find him just on, he's so far down because it's such a popular name that it gets populated by. Do you mean Stuart Alexander, the American politician? Like, even his contributions are pushed down the Google page, which is how we finally, you know, there's a pretty famous film director, Stuart Alexander. There's so many of them. It's kind of a popular name, so I shouldn't really blame our society on it. But sometimes these things do get pushed off the front page, and I think that's what this podcast is all about, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that area is lousy with Mike McCarthy's too.
Right? you better is. I met a guy this weekend who I think confessed to killing somebody for the IRA, and he was a cork man. And I mentioned that my last name was McCarthy, and he's like, oh, and I knew that there was a good chance that we were related, so I got the fuck out of Dodge. I'm going to keep going on to some odd medical practices, but I'm going to start with one of my favorite stories. We have kids. Jerry and I both have kids. Jerry and I at one time, and obviously Annie is listening in too, all three of us at one time have hated our kids, whether it was colicky or if they've had some sort of anything wrong with them, just fussy babies. Back in the mid-1800s, there was something that was insanely popular. Like Boudreaux's butt paste is something that was in everyone's diaper bag when they were having kids in the past 20 years. And Boudreaux's butt paste is like a triple butt paste that's perfect for getting diaper rashes away from kids. It's very, very effective. And if I found out that Boudreaux's butt paste contained crack cocaine, that's the equivalent of what's going on with this next story. There was something called Mrs. Winslow's Soothing Syrup. It was created by Charlotte Winslow, a pediatric nurse, as a cure-all for fussy babies. The syrup was first produced in 1849, and it was widely marketed in both North America and the United Kingdom. It was a big hit across the pond also. By 1868, for so less than 20 years, between 1849 and 1868, by 1868, they were selling over 1.5 million bottles of this every year. 1.5 million. And this wasn't a time where you can order 1.5 million as soon as you saw it on fucking Shark Tank. Right? So Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was the go-to cure-all for fussy babies. It was designed to calm and relax babies who were crying, they were teething, or had dysentery. It left the parent free to carry on with their daily lives uninterrupted by the incessant bawling of an upset child. I'm reading from the brochure. And the reason it worked so well is because it was a cocktail that included morphine, alcohol, and a mixture of other crazy-ass substances. This syrup contained 65 milligrams of morphine per ounce. One teaspoon was enough to kill the average child. Many babies went to sleep after taking the medicine, and unfortunately they never woke up again, leading to the syrup's nickname, the baby killer. Estimates put the number at thousands of children who died from either overdosing from it or from the subsequent addiction and withdrawal from being given this thing so much. I'm almost laughing about babies dying. Please don't take this as... But yeah. I just find the absurdity of it all. The way that we used to market and give people cocaine, morphine, and opiates so freely was unbelievable. Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was forced to remove the morphine from their formulation in 1911. So this whole shit kept going until 1911, and in a less deadly formula, they kept the name. And a less deadly formula of Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was still sold in the United States up until the 1930s.
And you know that there were people going, that's such pussy stuff. That's so right. Cancel culture. Oh, they're taking the morphine out. Oh, right. What a good night's sleep.
And they were saying, well, what is our baby supposed to have diarrhea? And opiates are known to be, to bind you. And so it was sort of like their way of taking whatever it is that you would take for diarrhea. What's the thing we take now? Imodium. It was like Imodium, but it was morphine. So Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was a go-to, and it had enough morphine to kill a fucking horse, much less an infant. And you were giving it to it in drops. Like, they used to give, like, laudanum back in the Tombstone days. But anyway, I love the name.
Look, if you want to get a good night's sleep and you're feeling lucky, try Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup.
Yeah. Urine therapy. We spoke about this when we spoke about plagues. Urine has been used as a curative in both medical and cosmetic world, and in many cultures and areas and eras, the ancient Romans, the Renaissance period, China, India, France, and it's still a predominant theory in Western culture to this day. It's used in teeth whitening, skin protection. I did a little TikTok showing how its antiseptic properties made it a very popular mouthwash. Back in ancient Rome, it's used to cure acne and strep throat. Sometimes the urine is ingested directly. Other times it's made into a compress or directly placed on the skin. So urine has always been a go-to also for people.
Huge for jellyfish bites.
Yes, jellyfish please stage. Piss on my leg. Yeah. Yep. And huge in R. Kelly videos. Ba-dum-bum. Bloodletting for thousands of years, and you had alluded to this earlier. Medical practitioners believed that sickness was merely a result of having bad blood. So bloodletting began with ancient Sumerians, which I believe Conan was a Sumerian, and Egyptians, became common practice during classical Greece and Rome. Hippocrates and Galen maintained that the human body was filled with four basic substances or humors. This is what you had mentioned before, Jerry. There was yellow bile, there was black bile, there was phlegm, and there was blood. Those were the four humors. And these needed to be kept in balance to maintain proper health. So with this in mind, patients with a fever or other ailments were often diagnosed with an overabundance of blood. So to restore this bodily harmony, the doctor would simply cut open a vein and drain some vital fluids into a receptacle. In some cases, leashes were even used to suck the blood directly from the skin. We've all seen the allusions to leashes and stuff in movies and whatnot. While it could easily result in accidental death from blood loss, phlebotomy endured as a common medical practice well into the 19th century. Medieval doctors prescribed blood draining as a treatment for everything from a sore throat to the plague. And some barbers listed it as a service along with haircuts and shaves. So they'd offer you a haircut, a shave, and then a quick bloodletting. That's a wild thing to think about, too. Like, we've all seen kind of that Barber of Seville type whatnot. Sweeney Todd, I think, is probably the most popular reference for that. But you can go to a barber, get a shave and a haircut, and a little bloodletting to balance out the humors. So that was phlebotomy. Another one that was not as popular, but one that I've also heard of, was trepanation. This was humanity's oldest form of surgery and also one of the more gruesome ones. Goes back as far as 7,000 years ago, the practice of boring holes into the skull as a means of curing illnesses. Researchers can only speculate how or why this grisly form of brain surgery was first developed. A common theory holds that it may have been some form of tribal ritual or even a method of releasing evil spirits believed to be possessed in the sick and the mentally ill. So in order to let these things go, we would drill a hole in your fucking skull. Others argue it was a more conventional surgery used to treat epilepsy, headaches, abscesses, and blood clots. Trepanned skulls found in Peru hint that it was also a common emergency treatment for cleaning out bone fragments left behind by skull fractures, and evidence showed that many of the patients survived the surgery. So for the last 7,000 years, on top of taking people's blood out in order to keep the humors balanced, sometimes you needed to get a little bit of a blow-off valve up top so they would bore holes into your skull. your feeling on that, Jer?
I remember that part in terribly underrated movie of the last 20 years, Master and Commander, where one of the guys takes a musket shot to the head, and not even the ship surgeon, like, has everyone, like you mentioned earlier, and that just standing around up above while he just pours, you know, takes a scalpel of some sort and just saws a perfect hole and then nails a coin into the guy's skull. And the guy was up walking and talking and no time flat. This was, you know, the Napoleonic Wars. So this is, you know, just more, a little over a century and a half ago. And absolutely, the stuff goes back into antiquity. Along with, by the way, you mentioned the phlebotomy. Some of the beliefs that people had going back to like ancient Rome and into the Middle Ages, where they thought that there were curative properties in blood of somebody who had just been killed, especially if they died a violent death. So people would like go to the gladiator fights in the Colosseum with cups. And if a gladiator was killed, they would like try to get some of that and drink it. There's stories of like, you know, medieval France that someone would be like hung for a crime, and people would run up and rub their faces with the hand of the deceased while he's still swinging, because they thought that would cure their epilepsy. It would clear up skin lesions, whatever. So yeah, the phlebotomy thing goes back, and it's not all that long ago that people dropped the idea of thinking there was magical properties in that.
Yeah, I think one led to the other. And so the category that I think the use of the blood fell into was this one that I had as cannibal cures. So it was one of those things where, King, 17th century, King Charles II, I believe he had a spaniel named after him, was known for enjoying a draft of King's Drops, a restorative brew made from crumbled human skull and alcohol. I'm talking about stuff that would happen from the leftovers of trepanation, perhaps. Then there are also people in the 12th century were known for keeping a stock of mummy powder, an extract made from ground up mummies that were looted from Egypt. Persistent headaches, muscle cramps, or stomach ulcers sufferers were once prescribed an elixir containing human blood, flesh, or bone. Corpse medicine is what it was called, and it was a disturbingly common practice for years. You had mentioned in particular, the Romans believed that the blood of fallen gladiators could cure epilepsy, right? So all of a sudden these gladiators would come there, and you would have to harvest their spilt blood. By consuming the remains of a deceased person, the patient also ingested part of their spirit, leading to increased vitality and well-being. The type of cure, cannibal cure, usually corresponded to the type of ailment. So eating a part of ground skull was good for migraines. Eating some form of reduced human fat was good for muscle aches. But getting a fresh stock of all these things could be a gruesome process. So in some cases, the sickly would attend executions, like guillotine executions and whatnot, in hope of getting a cheap cup of freshly killed human blood. So it like the trepanation and all this kind of stuff created a market for people to then use what came out of these people as a potential cure also. Nothing was wasted.
And a lot of these theories are still alive on QAnon. Like, that's how they say a lot of celebrities, like, look good into their 60s.
Baby blood.
Yeah,
baby essence. Yeah, I believe it.
So we've come a long way, really, as a people.
It was one about mercury. We all know that you shouldn't eat what's inside of a thermometer. I think we all know that. Toxic properties. But it was once a very common elixir and also a topical medication. Ancient Persians and Greeks considered a useful ointment, and 2nd century Chinese alchemists prized liquid mercury, which they call quicksilver, and red mercury sulfide for its supposed ability to increase lifespan and vitality. Some healers even promised that by consuming noxious brews containing poisonous mercury, sulfur, and arsenic, that their patients would gain eternal life and the ability to walk on water, which would be tough for me to pass up if I was in ancient China. You give me eternal life and the ability to walk on water, I might have bought that for three easy installments. From the Renaissance until the early 20th century, mercury was also used as a popular medicine for sexually transmitted disease like syphilis. There you go. While some accounts claim the heavy metal treatment was successful in fighting off the infection, patients often died from either liver or kidney damage caused by mercury poisoning.
And I think it might have killed Isaac Newton. But mercury? But to be fair, my source on this is Mac from It's Always Sunny. When he went on that rant about like, oh, what about Isaac Newton, smartest man in the world, died drinking mercury. So I don't know, maybe it's just bullshit. But I like to think that someone who's a million times smarter than me is the reason we have probes landing on Mars and our computers work was dumb enough to drink mercury. Makes me feel better about me.
Not to trump you, but Sir Isaac Newton, also from Park Ridge, New Jersey. That's not true at all. I just wanted to use that too. How's that? The last one that's going to be a wacky one is the smoke enema, the tobacco smoke enema, something that I'd give a whirl to. Why the fuck not? In the late 1700s, tobacco started to arrive on English shores from the Americas. Along with it came the idea that when used as an enema, blowing smoke up one's ass, literally, tobacco smoke could cure a wide range of ailments. As the name suggests, a tobacco smoke enema involves literally blowing smoke up the patient's rectum. The so-called pipe smoker London medic would use the technique on those who fell into the River Thames and near drowned. Tobacco smoke enemas were thought to both warm the patient from within, drowning patients from within, and stimulate respiration. The Royal Human Society left resuscitation kits, including the equipment necessary to carry out a tobacco enema, at certain points along the River Thames. So there you go. Every now and again, you'll see defibs inside of restaurants and whatnot. At one point in the 1700s, along the River Thames, you would see resuscitation kits that would allow you to light up a stogie and blow it up a drowning man's ass. And that was the tobacco smoke enema. I am going to end this, Jerry. I'm going to end this podcast right now, but I'm going to end it because it is the twisted history of bad medicine, right? You kind of came up with that name, and what it had gone back to is probably the only left turn that we've made today, bad medicine. Today is March 2nd. This podcast will be released tomorrow, Wednesday, March 3rd. But today is March 2nd, 2021. And it happens to be John Bon Jovi's 59th birthday.
Yeah, absolutely. Weird coincidence. And I got a shingle shot yesterday. I told you earlier, I've been knocked on my ass all day long. It's been a weird kind of everything coming together into this topic. And also from your town in New Jersey, right? Wasn't Bon Jovi?
He's down south, like somewhere along like the Rumson way. We have an unhealthy relationship with John Bon Jovi in this house. He was visiting the New York Stock Exchange and my wife followed him into a men's room. My wife is a Jersey girl, and for her 30th birthday, I rented out a box in the Meadowlands. Said that Citigroup, I think it was working for Citigroup at the time. Citigroup had given us a couple of tickets to the box, which they would often do. So we'd go up, but we'd have to be with clients. So we went regular, dressed to go see John Bon Jovi. And I'm older than Annie, so I was my mid-30s. She was turning 30. And we got up there, and instead of being with a bunch of Citigroup stiffs, it was all our family and friends, big time. But as I was watching her watch the show, like, it was magical. Like I was watching some sort of transformation. And it wasn't necessarily human that day, but her hair just started to get bigger. And the shirt that she wore transformed into a Wildwood t-shirt with like the tassel. And I think at one point she went to lift it up to show, and I had to stop her, you know what I mean? Because we're married and stuff at the time, stop showing off the goodies for real. But it was one of those things where it's a John Bon Jovi household. So
her jeans just acid washed themselves before your eyes.
They did. Yeah. It was like a magical potion had been cast above the woman I love. But
so what if this day next year we do Wanted Dead or Alive, and maybe 2023 we'll do Living on a Prayer?
Yeah, we could do the history of the Catholic Church Living on a Prayer. But I'm going to tell you right now, Bad Medicine is my favorite Bon Jovi song. It was released in September 1988 as the lead single from the band's fourth album, which was titled, obviously, New Jersey. The song reached number one on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. Bon Jovi's third single to do so became a top 10 hit in Australia, Canada, Finland, Ireland, Netherlands, and New Zealand, as well as the United States. And this one I love. I love when English soccer hooligans sing American songs for any kind of English fans. I was a big fan of Ricky Hatton, the boxer. And he had fought Floyd Mayweather in the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, which I've been to for fights. Humble brag. The MGM Grand, you can't get shit in there, Jer. It's casino and stuff. Like, they don't let you get stuff in. Ricky Hatton got destroyed by Floyd Mayweather. And all of Floyd's fans were gone. Ricky Hatton might have still been passed out in the middle of the thing. And there were still hooligans just packed in the cheap seats singing, "There's only one Ricky Hatton." Winter Wonder, we're walking along, walking in a Hatton Wonderland. There's only, and one of them snuck in a fucking trombone. I said, "How'd you get a trombone into a Vegas casino?"
Like, not a flute or a clarinet or an oboe.
Right. So you know the song Bad Medicine? Your love is like bad medicine. I don't think I have to sing that for anybody who's listening to this, but everyone knows I have a very good voice. I'm not afraid to use it. So now that there was a soccer player who played for Liverpool FC and also for Newcastle United, and the gentleman's name was Barry Venison. So everybody in the crowd used to sing, "Your love is like Barry Venison," and they used to sing it at the top of their fucking lungs. And I love the fact that that exists. And I guess John Bon Jovi does too. John Bon Jovi's real name is John Francis Bon Jovi Jr. He has sold over 130 million albums, 12 with his band Bon Jovi and two solo records that were probably terrible. This is something I didn't know. He was the son of an ex-Marine. Who cares? His mother, Carol Sharkey. Did you guys know this? She was a Playboy bunny.
Oh.
Yeah, Google the shit out of Carol Sharkey. I tell people to Google stuff. I like the cut of her jib. I don't think she was ever in the magazine, but she certainly was one of those bunny waitresses who obviously had the bustier and the ears and the thing. So Carol Sharkey, who John Bon Jovi's mom, was a Playboy bunny. This is another thing that me and Annie had witnessed firsthand. John Bon Jovi plays hurt. During the Slippery When Wet tour in 1987, which is a great rock and roll name for 1987, right? Like when Warren had Cherry Pie and the poster was the girl and the cherry pie fell in a perfect V right passing by her genitals. Fucking Slippery When Wet for a New Jersey rock album in 1987. Mwah. But in 1987, during that tour, he strained his vocal muscles. And he had to be rushed off stage where they gave him steroid injections. And then he went out to finish the live shows. I don't like to throw around the word warrior, but there you go. That was 1987. Fast forward to 2010. We're in the Meadowlands. John Bon Jovi in the Meadowlands towards the end of a concert that we're also at. Jumps up. Just does a jump up. Tears a calf muscle. This is how old he is now. Gets taken off the stage. Wrapped it up. Comes out. And he does the encore, Living on a Prayer. It's the last thing I'll tell you about John Bon Jovi.
He's so old that the therapy was they blew smoke up his ass.
Yeah, they blew some smoke up his ass.
That's what he did when he was a kid.
Some mercury and urine on it. Yeah. And this is, I like to make sure everyone gets shit on a little bit on this podcast. In 2011, John Bon Jovi apparently paid $200 worth of property taxes. $200. He owns 6.5 acres in Middletown, New Jersey, which is on something called the Navisink River, which is gorgeous. Paid $200 in property taxes, which is unbelievable. And the reason he did that is because he uses a portion of his land to raise bees.
Beekeeper. Right. Yep, yeah, exactly. That
move enables you to receive government subsidies. So for his lavish estate, he paid $200 in fucking property taxes. Bruce Springsteen, the patron saint of New Jersey, has a similar scam going. Leasing land on his estate, his sprawling estate down in wherever the hell he is, Little Silver or Rumson or something, to organic farmers. So that the boss also decided to be born in the USA, but not necessarily pay all our taxes.
Right.
So
basically, less in property taxes than it costs to have a seat at one of their shows.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
Springsteen was getting twice that for that Broadway thing he did. where it was just him playing his old songs acoustically and telling stories of, I was working in my daddy's garage, Rattlesnake Speedway, Utah Desert. Meanwhile, like, all these beautiful people are in his audience in, like, furs and, like, designer shoes.
I implore people, for people who like reading, I implore people, because if you like reading and you like history and you like Wall Street, I wrote a blog almost 2 years ago, and it's called Shotgun John Puts the Fun in Funeral. That was the name of the blog. So if you want to search it on the thing, Shotgun John. And it was about a guy named John Mulhern, who is a Wall Street legend. He was called Shotgun John because he went after Ivan Boesky with a shotgun. We were lucky enough that he was close friends with my father-in-law, and later on became very close friends with my wife in the months and the weeks and months after 9/11. And when John passed away, we were lucky enough to be invited to his funeral. It was an invite-only type thing. We were actually invited inside the church. There was a secondary thing outside where you're watching on closed-circuit TV. And when my wife and I sat down for this funeral, and the stage had too many musical instruments on it, we were 100% dumbfounded when Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, everybody but Clarence, got up and started to perform. And then we're at a funeral. And then Bruce Springsteen says, John, can you, and then John Bon Jovi comes out of the fucking crowd, grabs a tambourine, and then they bring the body in on a fucking hovercraft. And the pallbearers are wearing Cheetah Rivera baskets of fruit on their head, and they got shotguns full of glitter, and his horse-drawn fucking classic fire. It was an absolute scene, and about a legend of South Jersey, a legend of Wall Street. He's done a lot of charitable work and whatnot, and a crazy son of a bitch, John Mulhern. And so I implore you, if you feel like reading something interesting, if you like this podcast, Shotgun John Puts the Fun in Funeral. I wrote it a couple of years ago. But that's it. So that's Bad Medicine. We close it off with John Bon Jovi because it needs to be closed off with John Bon Jovi. Jerry, as usual, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. John and I had mentioned it in the middle of this show that we're trying to put the concert T-shirts into it. I think we'll probably have them within the next couple of weeks. It's going to be very cool. And then John and I are also working on this thing. Actually, John, Annie, and I, there's a new service which is going to be able, it's called 2 Cents. You'll be able to listen to this. I think you'll like this too, Jer. You'll be able to listen to Twisted History, just Twisted History. I believe it will be the only beta if I can get this thing put through. And then after the show is done, you'll be able to, on an app, leave 30 seconds of commentary for everyone to hear. So if this drops on Wednesday, you listen to it on Wednesday, anyone who listens to it on Thursday, your 30 seconds will be tagged on. So if 30 people leave something, it'll be an extra 15 minutes of people saying, hey, Large, hey, John, hey, St. Ed, make sure you look into John Bon Jovi's this, or you want to take a look at this, you want to take a look, or just say, hey, eat a dick, or you're wrong on this, and Mercury's at anything. So it's something that's coming down the pipe, which I think is going to make the experience a little bit more one-on-one, because we love the feedback that we get on all the social media stuff. At Twisted History is where you get us. TikTok, we'll be doing a Twisted History fact every day. We're trying to refine it. John yells at me, so it's not that effective. But we're just trying to do everything that we can. Jerry, the books that you wrote are what?
From Darkness to Dynasty, that's the weird, funny, hilarious, tragic early history of the Patriots. And the most recent one is called Six Rings, which speaks for itself, kind of bookending the first championship to the last championship. And I think there's laughs in there that have been really well received. And I've now officially written more books than I've read.
It was an old Lou Holtz line. I love when, I'm already putting him in the ground along. He's buried next to Francis. Jerry is obviously can be found on the blog at any time, and obviously wherever the hell you buy books, if you just Google Jerry Thornton, you can get all of them, including his latest one, Six Rings. So thanks everybody for listening. Please keep those recommendations coming in on what you think we should handle. I think next week Vibs and I might do a reader's choice, just because they always seem to be very, very cool. And we'll talk to you next week. Have a great one.
We'll be right back.